It was early. Earlier than one wants to be up when at an island resort. Day 3 of a luxury vacation planned by Galinda and myself as a way to celebrate the impossible work of these last few years. Helping our niece Katrina navigate the pandemic with her now teen daughter Pepsi. Clearing out my parents' house, grief, and then of course a year's worth of fading in and out of existence. Time traveling to specific points in my own life that stood out or offered guidance. It was like being haunted from within, secrets held, inaccessible to me, revealing themselves as I moved through loss and fear and graceful acceptance. So on the third day, on a small island in the Caribbean, naturally, we booked a couple's sound bath. What better way to attune our personal vibrations to those of the universe? Join in harmony with the white clouds that permanently encircled the neighboring volcanic peak. Become one with the tropical breeze of colonizers past. Match the feeling in your teeth with that of the voracious incisors of the brightly colored frangipani caterpillars, the poisonous rasta worm, as they bite into the sturdy leaves of its namesake plant. Take a paddleboard of the mind and rock gently in time with the waves of that crystal clear water. Allow your insides to ebb and flow as you too can be a home for the turtles and rays and horse-eyed jacks and reef sharks. At least that's what was promised on the brochure. Tashanda at the front desk helped us secure the reservation. Tashanda with a ready smile, who always called to confirm or check on something the minute we got back to the suite, leaving me to wonder if she was monitoring us and how. But after the third or fourth rum punch, I forgot to worry about it. I watched the daily rain cloud form and then dissipate over the ocean. At 7:30 a.m., the sun was already hot. I spent the afternoon snorkeling the day before, but because I forgot to pack my swim turtleneck, which offers full-throated SPF protection against UV rays, I sustained a pretty solid sunburn on my wrists and upper back, my erogenous zones both. My advice for you traveling to this part of the world, remember, the sun is more intense, and it reflects off and through every surface. You know how you can see all the way to the bottom of the ocean? Turns out, that's because the sun can get all the way down in there. Not like New Jersey beaches, where the sun has to move through industrial runoff, green fly larva, and discarded hoagie wrappers. If you're under the water there, you're 100% safe. But in the islands, there is no such protection. And if you are, as I was, a little cavalier about this and just give a cursory spray to your back without having your partner or reluctant stranger rub that stuff in, well, you're going to end up sleeping on your stomach on account of how much the thin cotton sheets hurt every time you roll over. But by the third day of constant cooling gel application and a few hearty trips to that breakfast buffet, I was feeling well enough to have my body surrounded by healing waves of sound. So having gotten up, splashed some cool water on my face, and gargled some dentist-prescribed mouthwash to help with inflamed gums, Galinda and I headed across the small paved road to greet our sound bath conductor. This particular island has been the home to many peoples. Because of its position, it was claimed by seafaring tribes, the Kalingo, then invaded by the British, and then the French. Those last two kept fighting over the territory for 100 years or so. Enslaved people were brought to the island, sugar plantations built, rebellions fought as people survived, or didn't, through earthquakes, hurricanes, and floods. Emancipation and independence finally came, not without hardship and struggle. The French introduced monkeys, which now outnumber people in population. There's a sign at the airport that says, "Welcome, we have too many monkeys." It was only recently, 20 years or so ago, that sugar production was completely shut down on the island, prompting a major pivot away from the only real industry the island had known for 350 years. Now, tourism would be the key to their adaptation strategy. Similar to Iceland, really, although who knows what they did before tourism. Sell ice, I guess. which is how you get a sound bath happening in a circular stone structure built to resemble an old sugar mill at 7:30 in the morning. Now, did I think it was an actual sugar mill? Yes. Do I know what a sugar mill looks like? I still don't, and I went to every part of the sugar mill spa. Would it be more troubling to find out you were enjoying luxury and relaxation in a place of actual toil and labor? Not sure. The whole scenario is kind of bad, so I think it might be better to not think about it too hard at this moment, and then even a month later when you're doing a podcast episode about it, just also not think about it, and then maybe find some way to atone for this a little further down the road. Dressed in our most relaxing drawstring pants, holdovers from the year we spent inside eating mushroom soup and disinfecting boxes of Wheat Thins, thanks, pandemic, we were greeted on the lawn by a woman in multiple layers of caftan. She had at least three, maybe four, different fabrics draped over one another. What little of her neck one could see peeked out from behind a substantial pile of necklaces, garlands, really, strung with lava rock beads and jade-green stones. The tinted lenses of her enormous sunglasses reflected the morning light as she took our hands in hers and welcomed us to our sound journey. She introduced herself. "I'm Dale." Which was enough to bring a smile to my face as I said, "Mine too!" When we stared at each other with large smiles, not saying a word, but also not really laughing, just holding the gaze for a beat beyond comfortable. She said, "Welcome to our island." Now, I don't know about you, but I've lived in New York for 16 years, and I've never once said, "Welcome to our island." I certainly would hesitate to say such a thing if I were a white woman of a certain age living in a place where I am at best a minority, at worst part of a legacy of colonialism. Our island was a bit of a stretch, but getting into it first thing in the morning was more of a New York thing, and here I am not in New York trying to get away from all that. So I said, "Thank you," and we were ushered across the small stone path that led to the sugar mill structure. I had visited the structure on our first day there, curious as to what it was. I popped in between rum tastings and dunks in the adults-only pool. For the first 4 days, I was the only one I ever saw swim in the adults-only pool, so if you were thinking that was going to be some kind of wet hole for swingers, or just a place where grown-ups enjoyed doing handstands, you'd be mistaken and maybe a little disappointed. But walking into the Sugar Mill Sound Bathatorium alone that day was kind of great. It has no ceiling, just a circular opening to the sky. You could stand and watch a cloud move quickly by, or just marvel at how blue the sky was. So blue it stung a little to look right at it. Walking in with Galinda and Lady Dale, the space was different. An odd totem-like sculpture was still there, but now it shared a tiny stage-like area with a gong. At least two rain sticks, something I had not thought about since college, when they were briefly all the rage in the quad, complimenting the work done by Hacky Sack Sportsman and whatever that stick thing was that was essentially Hacky Sack you played with your hands. Even among art students, this was a particular subset of characters. They wore almost exclusively tie-dye, and to the extent that they ever wore shoes, they wore sandals in Providence in the winter. I guess a shorter way to say this was the glass department. Anyway, yes, rain sticks, and then a few other instruments that I didn't recognize or just didn't pay enough time looking at to figure out what they were. I'm sure it was a standard kit for the traveling Soundbathian. We took off our slip-on shoes, brushing off the sand from the soles of our feet, or in my case, socks. I wasn't sure if this was going to be a group-type deal, and I didn't want anybody's first impression of me to be uncut toenails. Also, I didn't want to see anyone else's feet, but that's always a risk that I have just found a way to live with. It's like knowing pickles exist. I don't want to see them, be near them, or smell them, but I have accepted that to eat at my favorite burger place is to endure the presence of a pickle. One thing I regret in the story so far is mentioning toes and pickles in the same breath. Those two should never mix. I apologize for linking the two in your mind. Galinda took her spot on the yoga mat to the left, and I spread out on the yoga mat on the right. I guess we went right to our same positions that we sleep in. For consistency's sake, I wonder if all couples do that. Naturally fall into a this-side-is-mine-forevermore, I guess, situation when faced with a lying-down-on object. We positioned a little towel under our knees and one for our neck, and I immediately closed my eyes, waiting for the gong to produce soothing ripples of relaxation. Something a gong is maybe not really equipped to do. The first strike of the gong was indeed a little shocking. I was glad I had used the restroom right before, because otherwise I would have needed a different kind of bath. Lady Dale spoke to us in hushed tones, not as breathy as a Republican senator giving the GOP response to the State of the Union, but similar, a tad lower, less handmaid soprano and more White Lotus alto. Whenever Dale spoke, you were reminded that the island she probably should be welcoming you to is Vancouver Island. Between hits on her mighty gong, I detected the subtle intonations of a life led in the banking sector of far western Canada. At some point, as she informed us about the journey we were about to be on, as the waves of sound would wash over us, as the vibrations would all become one, as she spoke in a pattern that was not unfamiliar to me from so many relaxation tapes that I have both made and listened to, I became aware that my hands had nothing to do, and I needed to make a decision about how they were going to be situated. Palms up was better to mask the horrible sunburn on my wrist, and maybe more open to the sky and the spirits and vibrations, but on their side was slightly more comfortable. I tried to make a little correction to them, but that tweaked my shoulder, so I had to rotate them back into a half-up, half-down place. It was not ideal, and they started to tingle to sleep after a little while. I kept my eyes closed through this, but I'm sure they were darting side to side within my eyelids like REM sleepers. At some point, I realized that I was on a wrist journey and not a sound journey, and so I just let the tingles have their way and tried to breathe into the areas that were causing me stress. The gong had given way to what I imagined was a synthesizer, but that could not have been true. Just as I was spinning out, trying to piece together how Lady Dale had brought in power to the sugar mill with no outlets, she started singing. Well, howling. Or chanting, I guess. It was an incantation of nonsense, with words that were not words repeated over and over again, kind of in rhythm, but also very much out of rhythm. I almost started laughing. I had no idea what was happening, but I also knew that we paid $75 apiece for this, so I was not about to give up. Maildale was in it for the long haul, or an hour, or however long this was supposed to last. Thankfully, she picked up another instrument and started using that to bounce sound from one side of the structure to the other. There was one low frequency that finally locked in for me. It made me feel very much at ease and surrounded in comfort. It was probably 40 minutes into the journey, but there it was. I recognized it, and it recognized me, and from that point on, I was feeling the sound bath. It was a curious thing, a melting of physical form into less physical form. A lightness was in me. I was vibing, as the teens in the all-swim pool would say. There was also something incredibly beautiful that was happening in that moment. An unplanned part of the journey that Lady Dale made the most of as she brought the sound bath to a close with a few final words and turns of the rain stick. The low sustained cooing of the Zenaida doves, a relative of the mourning dove that thrives on the Caribbean islands, a more beautiful and more emotionally available pigeon. The sound of that bird was echoing throughout the sugar mill. It came in through the hole where the ceiling would be and encircled us over and over again, layering its sad song as it echoed, bending around the notes of the gong it made for a deeper melody, an ancient song. The story of those doves is that their appearance signals the arrival of a spirit, of a loved one who has gone on. And maybe that's what was happening. For me, it triggered moments of summer weekends at home with our windows all open, a little fan running in the middle of the room, a gentle cross breeze keeping things cool in the days before air conditioning, and my dad mowing the lawn outside or weeding or working in the garage, the sound of a mourning dove on the telephone wire cooing that same song. And maybe that was an ancestor too. Maybe they all are. And maybe the echoes of things are all that we are and all that we experience. The moment I had that memory, my eyes started to water, and afraid to move my hands for fear of not getting the position right again, I had to let the tear roll down my cheek to be absorbed in the towel underneath my neck. And then the sound bath was over. But what about that? The echoes of things. Reverberations that keep moving along with us, defining us, intersecting with us at odd moments. Well, that sounds like the kind of thing we should explore when we strike our own personal gongs with our mind mallets and ride the sound waves into a place we call the Deep Night. Oh, friends, hello. It's me, Dale Seaver, and I'm pulsing with all sorts of vibrations as I join you once again as your host and companion through this, the Deep Night. We come to you tonight, as we always do, from the foul banks of the Gowanus, a place where if you wanted to take a paddleboard out into the water, you'd better have a lot of confidence in your ability to stay upright. I gave paddleboarding a go again in the islands, and I gotta say, not for me. I knew that the first time we went in a marina somewhere in New Jersey. It was just my niece Katrina, Pepsi, and myself, none of whom had ever thought about paddleboarding before. Imagine we thought there'd be some kind of instruction as to what to do or how to stay up. But the very nice lady dropped off the boards 30 minutes late, tossed some oars and a life jacket at our feet, and left us on our own. We had to walk down a narrow, muddy path lined with reeds to what qualifies as a beach on that side of the Verrazano, a small patch of wet earth lapped by the tide. We all set our boards in the murky water and kneeled on them, praying not to fall in, because the only thing visible in the brownness of that water were hundreds of milky white jellyfish pulsing sideways and out in all directions. Every now and again you would forget about them, but the movement of an oar or the occasional waves made by a passing motorboat would disturb them, and up they would rise, bouncing against the boards and then submerging again. We paddled out and under an overpass because New Jersey, and that's around the time that, having not seen a jellyfish in a while, I tried to stand up and immediately wobbled off and into the water. I was surprised to learn I could stand. I was less shocked to feel what felt like sludge under my feet. Not quite solid, not quite liquid, but all gross. So I tried, in what must be the most humiliating aspect of any paddle journey, to pull my body weight up and onto the board, like a whale beaching themselves and hoping for death. In the end, the real tragedy was that at her young age, Pepsi didn't really have the upper body strength or fortitude to paddle all the way back to shore against the current which had suddenly made itself known. The sun was slipping behind the interstate, and as the marina took on a dim glow of twilight, we were very stuck with a long way to go and no one really capable in what they were doing. As in most things, though, one must just persist, will themselves to the proverbial, or in this case, literal shore. We linked up our boards and relied on each other to haul ourselves back to that little muddy patch where Pepsi threw down her oar and Katrina and I took turns lugging the boards back through the reeds and onto the little carrier still parked at the lot. But things that happened once seem to happen again, sometimes change, sometimes we've changed and merely receive things differently. There are these echoes, though, aren't there? Weird parallels. Some people look to them, hope for them, sell books based on theories concocted about them, start religions. People get into all sorts of things when faced with the uncanny, or even more so by that which is reassuring. We want there to be patterns in the universe. The older I get, the less convinced I am that it's pattern building as it is sound wave distortion, bouncing from one universal set of speakers to the next. Cosmic feedback, maybe. Not so much simulation as it is note moving and twisting through space, an inky bay full of loping, looping jellyfish. The jellyfish which is itself immortal, beginning its new life from an old one endlessly forever. I was thinking about this while participating in a stargazing lesson on the beach at the resort. Tashanda again had helped me set up what I hoped would be a romantic and fun look at the stars above the islands. The sky seemed clear the first two nights we were there, and with such little light pollution, I was looking forward to an extraordinary look into the Milky Way. But like a few things I booked on this trip, the activity didn't go exactly as I thought it would, which is probably an echo I should pay more attention to. For instance, the pre-booked glass-bottom kayak trip through the bay ended up being another muddy hike through tall grasses and weeds. And when we reached the supposed destination, a man eating soup from a styrofoam container said, "This should be the place." But the place was an abandoned dock that had not been used in some time. And once the man eating soup finished his lunch, it was just Galinda and I staring out into the ocean as the sun continued to beat down on us, desperate to find some way in through the strands of my newly purchased sunshirt. We passed the boat tour operator as we were climbing back into our taxi, the event having been a bust. "We're ready for you," he shouted from the window of his van. "We thought the tour began at 2. I said, "Well, it was always 1, and it's too late now," because if you saw the expression on Galinda's face, you would know that it was time to go. I had to get this gal back to the poolside smoothie bar. I think the lesson there was, don't leave the resort. Back on the resort's campus the night before, we met our astronomy guide, Percival, on the steps outside the main reception area, far enough away from the fisherman's shanty-themed restaurant so that we weren't bothering anyone eating, but close enough that we learned about Jupiter's 95 moons to the score of Margaritaville. Spending time with Percival and his telescope was not romantic. If anything, it skewed pedantic. It was more like being in a middle school science classroom. We were grilled on space knowledge we could not possibly possess or haven't had access to in 30 or more years. Yet still, Percival persisted. "What is the speed of light? What star is this we're looking at? Where is the North Star?" etc. Now, it maybe didn't help that as Percival was busy exhausting his knowledge of Jupiter, clouds were slowly spreading across the sky behind him, and I watched in real time as the moon was blocked out, and then all the other constellations. Somehow, the sky opened again, and we had just enough time to train the telescope on a few high points of our little solar system. Every now and again he'd use a very powerful green laser pin to shine a light at a star or a planet. And amidst talk of how the stars we're looking at are actually in the past, and that stargazing is a form of time travel, I began to wonder about the people on the other end of that laser pointer, looking up to see a bright green light zip toward them. Maybe it shone bright enough for long enough in some distant place that it was used to navigate vessels across their seas. I hope aliens got a chance to do some colonizing. It would be a shame to have hoarded that all for ourselves. At the end of the stargazing lesson, Percival said he had one more thing to show us. From an interior pocket of his briefcase, he removed two small plastic boxes lined with foam. He asked us to hold out our hands, and he carefully placed a sliver of metallic rock into Galinda's generous palm. He explained that this was a meteorite, a shooting star. He took out the other and placed it in my hand, one that was lighter in composition owing to less iron in its makeup. "It will never not be extraordinary to hold something that has traveled through space for eons, that crashed through our atmosphere without being completely turned to ash, to hold an object like that in your hands. A tangible fragment of the night sky." We thanked Percival. I did tell him that he should have led with the meteorite, because that was maybe the best part. And then as we walked away, I wondered whether or not I should have tipped him. The thing about echoes we encounter, the ones bouncing off the sides of the ever-expanding multiverse, swooping around black holes, ricocheting off distant asteroids, is that by the time they reach us again, they are in no recognizable linear pattern. no single continuous beam of laser light. Notes released from their music, their small echoes and big echoes, ones that are obvious and ones less so. You can share the same name as your father. That's kind of an echo. See similar patterns in behavior. Recognize similar impulses. That feeling that you have become your parents in some way. My inherited traits or inherited structures that allow me / make it inevitable to have the same reactions to things, to yield too quickly to stress, slip into anger at a tiny slight, or indulge in one too many mini guava cheese pastries at the breakfast buffet. But that resort buffet was $50 a person, so I attribute my inherited trait there as being the need to get value out of something. The way echoes move and you catch up with them at weird moments, like how my mother taught me the phrase, "Beware the Ides of March," and then she died right around that time during High Ides. Why was that the thing that stood out for me? Why that phrase out of all the Shakespearean things she could have imparted? I remember no sonnet or section as clearly, but that warning of impending death, that stuck with me as if it had already happened. An echo from the future. You can hear something, observe something, and then years later that same thing comes back again. More than just trend or fad or nostalgia is far too specific. Sometimes it can feel as if I'm just given a certain set of words from the get-go, and then you just keep assembling them and reassembling them as you live throughout your life until they're all exhausted. And I have many more examples, but I keep them mostly to myself in case speaking them sets about another set of echoes. A protective, superstitious quiet. So maybe there was a big bang, or maybe that was an echo of another bang, and the same things keep reverberating through the walls of the cosmos, the unknown, sound waves all. Pythagoras being somewhat right about the music of the spheres, but it's not original music. It's happened before, the same bars, same patterns and notes. And it can be tempting to hear only the lower notes, the dark vibrations. Maybe they travel better, hold their shapes more firmly, so that we can easily think that we're letting a parent down, if that's the only echo you hear, or if that's the one you hear first. I certainly can be swept up in the booming sounds of perceived disappointment, that somehow I've made a wrong choice. But that's only because the lighter sounds take a minute to come back to me. That quiet, ethereal beats of pride and joy and laughter, they don't always register at first. But if one can get very still, say, in a sound bath installed within a recreation of a sugar mill, you might be able to hear them. The low ones still come through first, but give it a moment. They're all mixed in there with the sounds of a cooing mourning dove and an older lady chanting, and the sound of your own breath trying not to laugh at the situation you find yourself in. Friends, that's all I have for this week, or I guess month, given our new frequency of episodes. I trust you'll take a little something from this, maybe recognize an echo or two in your own existence. Listen for the high notes, is my advice. They are there. And yes, my sunburn has finally faded, so I no longer fear soft fabrics. There are some shifts on the horizon, some light weaving happening, and I look forward to sharing all of that with you when the time is right. But till then, thank you for listening, and remember that although this night is ending, a bright new day is just ahead. Deep Night with Dale is independently produced, performed, and written by James Bewley. Podcast theme by Via Mardo. Season artwork by Victor Bizar Gomez. Photography this season by Emma Mead. New website design by Maria Belen of Bella Mona Designs. All of these artists are wonderful and worth looking up and following on social media or hiring for your next great thing. For everything Dale and Deep Night, true denizens of the deep should visit deepnightshow.com or tune into the show on Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts can be found. Remember to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts and follow Dale on Instagram @DaleSeaver. Thanks for paying a visit to the Deep Night.